Today is Thursday, October 21st, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Gene Rofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Taliban pledges to resist militant groups.
We know that Islamic State's local branch emerged on the Afghan scene in 2015, but we haven't seen the frequency of the attacks that we have witnessed over the last 2 weeks.
Plus, U.S. offers dialogue with North Korea without conditions.
And it is time to engage in sustained and substantive dialogue toward the goal of complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Also, riot groups fear persecution for returning Syrian refugees. Our top story today is in Russia. The Taliban pledged that Afghanistan will not be a base for militant groups and would seek to create an inclusive government during talks in Russia on Wednesday. The meeting involved senior representatives of the Taliban and some neighboring countries. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov emphasized that, quote, forming a really inclusive government fully reflecting the interests of not only all ethnic groups, but all political forces of the country, unquote, is necessary to achieve a stable peace in Afghanistan. Russia has worked for years to establish contacts with the Taliban, even though it designated the group a terrorist organization in 2003. Lavrov, in his opening speech, commended the Taliban for their effort to stabilize the country and ensure an operating government. Can the Taliban keep its promise amid fears of the resurgence of Al-Qaeda and Islamic State terror groups? For more, I reached out to VOA's Ayaz Gaul.
What we have seen on the ground is that the number of attacks in Afghanistan has been unusually high over the last 2 months. We know that Islamic State's local branch emerged on the Afghan scene in 2015, but we haven't seen the frequency of the attacks that we have witnessed over the last 2 weeks, and it has killed and injured hundreds of people. Like in just two attacks that the Islamic State's militants carried out this month, around 200 people have been killed. They are mostly Shia. And in response, the Taliban, they are under criticism, obviously, for not providing security to these mosques and other areas, even to their own fighters. They have been insisting that they are conducting operations. And as a day earlier, Taliban spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid claimed that these operations have rounded up more than 250 militants linked to Islamic State and that they have been able to uproot some of their bases. There are worries once again in Afghanistan because two back-to-back Fridays witnessed two devastating suicide bombings, and this is now the third Friday that we are entering into tomorrow. So the concerns are if this Friday will also be witnessing another attack. But on the ground, as of now, as of today, we really haven't seen anything concrete on part of the Taliban that would convince the international community that they are capable of dealing with this threat on their own. And that is why there have been suggestions from outside of Afghanistan that they really need some kind of cooperation, be it the United States or other countries.
The Taliban also promised an inclusive government, but indications are, at least from their first cabinet, that that is not happening. Are there plans to broaden the government and bring in women and other people who are stakeholders in the country?
That was one of the main subjects in the meeting that Moscow hosted on Wednesday, that whether the Taliban have met their promises that there will be an inclusive government and that women will be free to do whatever they want in public life. So we heard the Taliban Deputy Prime Minister Abdul Salam Hanafi delivering a speech to the Moscow meeting yesterday where he defended against this criticism that the government is not inclusive. He strongly defended that it is an inclusive government, that it represents all Afghan ethnic and political groups in the country. So what we see is that most of the international community, all the countries in general, are not satisfied with the current political setup in Kabul, that it is comprising Taliban, who are Pashtun as far as the ethnicity is concerned. And there are other ethnicities who have representatives according to the Taliban in the government, but they're in a very small number. So on Taliban's part, they are defending this is an inclusive government, but we saw clearly that Pakistan, which is the neighboring country, China, Russia, all these countries, including Iran, were present in yesterday's meeting, and they all issued a joint statement where the focus of the statement was that Taliban need to put in place an inclusive government if they want to have lasting peace in Afghanistan. Otherwise, there were fears expressed in the meeting that this civil conflict may reemerge and will continue in the country.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gaul speaking with me from Islamabad. The U.S. said it supported the talks but was unable to attend for, quote, logistical reasons. State Department spokesman Ned Price did not elaborate on those reasons, but his comments come just hours before the U.S. Special Envoy for Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, resigned. The resignation was effective on Tuesday, and his successor, Thomas West, was not prepared to join the Moscow meeting, officials said. The United Nations said on Thursday it has set up a special trust fund to promote urgently needed cash directly to, quote, people's economy, unquote, in Afghanistan by tapping into donor funds frozen since the Taliban takeover in August. The UN said the aim is to inject liquidity into Afghan households to permit them to survive this winter and remain in their homeland. A. Kim Steiner, the U.S. Development Program Administrator, said that Germany had pledged 50 million euros to the fund and that it was in touch with other donors to mobilize resources. At a news conference, Steiner said the UN wants to stabilize the economy to save lives and livelihoods. The challenge, he said, is the need to, quote, repurpose, unquote, donor funds already earmarked for Afghanistan, where the Taliban, the de facto authorities, are not recognized. The United States ambassador to the United Nations says Washington has offered to meet North Korea without conditions, and made clear it has no hostile intent towards Pyongyang. Linda Thomas-Greenfield made the comments on Wednesday as the Security Council met over North Korea's latest missile launch. North Korea has been subjected to UN sanctions since 2006, which have been steadily strengthened in a bid to cut off funding for Pyongyang's nuclear and ballistic missiles program. The measures include a ban on ballistic missile launches. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and then U.S. President Donald Trump met three times in 2018 and 2019, but failed to make progress on U.S. calls for Pyongyang to give up its nuclear weapons and North Korea's demand for an end to sanctions. Thomas Greenfield said President Joe Biden's administration was, quote, prepared to engage in serious and sustained diplomacy, unquote.
This is the latest in a series of reckless provocations. Since the beginning of September, the DPRK has launched multiple ballistic missiles, one of which the DPRK claimed included a new hypersonic glide vehicle capability. These are unlawful activities. They are in violation of multiple Security Council resolutions, and they are unacceptable. Each new advancement of the DPRK's weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile programs destabilizes the region and threatens international peace and security. Our position remains clear. The DPRK must abide by the Security Council resolutions, and it is time to engage in sustained and substantive dialogue toward the goal of complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
That's U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. North Korea has hit back at U.S. criticism over its test of a submarine-launched ballistic missile this week. Pyongyang said it was exercising its rights for self-defense and that weapons doesn't specifically target the United States. The comments from North Korea's foreign ministry on Thursday came as the U.N. Security Council was set to convene in an emergency closed-door meeting over the launch that was called by the United States and the United Kingdom. North Korea has conducted 8 missile launches this year, but South Koreans, who have the most to lose from a conflict with North Korea, aren't overly concerned. More from VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul.
Every North Korean missile launch can feel intense. North Korean missile footage often has a Hollywood flair, complete with multiple camera angles and even drone shots. International media coverage can also convey a sense of crisis. From the outside, it's easy to look at the headlines and assume South Koreans are probably very concerned. But talk to them and you'll probably hear a different story. Yu Ye-jin is a Seoul resident. She says her first thought was, well, they did it again. The truth is, she says, South Koreans don't care about North Korean launches. Another Seoul resident, Song Tae-ho, says he feels as if he is immune to the news of North Korean missile tests. He just doesn't see it as a big deal. A lot of it may be alarm fatigue. North Korea has tested about 150 missiles since 1984, Seoul-based analyst Choi Jin-bong says people are used to North Korea's tests.
This is our life. This is our situation between North and South Korea. We have tension between those two countries, but the South Korean people think North Korea not gonna attack us. That's our belief.
It's been decades since major hostilities, and more than 10 years since the most recent notable violence, when North Korea shelled a South Korean island and sunk a warship, killing 50 people. But polls suggest young people who didn't experience the 1950s Korean War don't care as much about the North. Journalist Kim Hae-in says scary reports about North Korea just aren't as convincing these days. And many of the South Korean reports turn out to be inaccurate anyway, she says. Another reason for confidence is South Korea's own military. South Korea is developing more of its own weapons, such as these fighter jets on display at a defense expo this week. President Moon Jae-in, who arrived at the event in one of the new jets, says the state-of-the-art weapons should help South Korea feel secure, that it can keep the peace. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Anthony Blinken is making a major push for democracy on his first journey to South America as U.S. Secretary of State, visiting two democracies, Ecuador and Colombia, at a time of rising violence, authoritarianism, and populism in the region. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Secretary of State Anthony Blinken praised the stable democracies of Colombia and Ecuador on Wednesday, even though he arrived in Ecuador just as new President Guillermo Lasso declared a state of emergency to combat drug-related violence. Blinken said the Biden administration realizes that in the past, the U.S. has focused too much on training and equipping security forces and promoting democratic elections in the region, and not enough on boosting people's economic well-being.
This should be obvious, but the reality is we've often put more energy into strengthening civil and political rights, as vital and important as they are, free and fair elections, the rule of law, freedom of speech and assembly, and less into strengthening people's economic and social rights, like bolstering labor standards, expanding access to adequate education and health, providing more inclusive opportunities.
Blinken also received a warm welcome in Bogota, Colombia, from President Iván Duque. Duque was criticized after Colombian forces had killed dozens of anti-government protesters this year. But as Benjamin Gadan of the Wilson Center told VOA, Colombia is a critical U.S. ally in the region.
Colombia is a longtime United States ally in a very difficult part of Latin America. Of course, its neighbor, Venezuela, is a failed state and a deeply repressive dictatorship. The result has been almost 6 million Venezuelans fleeing in recent years, and perhaps half of them have settled in neighboring Colombia.
The political impasse in Venezuela and the resulting humanitarian crisis were high on the agenda at both of Blinken's stops. That partly explains why Blinken focused on the urgency of promoting democracy in the region, as Gadan explains.
But in reality, Latin America is living through a real democratic crisis right now. Nicaragua, Venezuela, of course, Cuba are all authoritarian right now. And countries like El Salvador are moving in that direction. Even Brazil has shown some warning signs lately about the respect for independent judiciaries and other democratic institutions.
Governments not able to deliver economically contribute to the migration crisis we are witnessing and make Blinken's push for democracy even more timely, Keith Mines of the United States Institute of Peace told VOA.
There's the kind of low-functioning democracies in other parts of Central America that are not able to provide fully for their citizens and leads to migration crises and things like that. And then, of course, the failed democracy of Haiti, which is just one that has kind of left the realm of functionality altogether.
Mind said China is promoting a very different model. Secretary Blinken said the United States is not trying to force any country to choose between it and China, but it is seeking to promote the highest possible standards for human rights and living and working conditions for all citizens of the Americas. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Human Rights Watch says dozens of Syrian refugees who fled the country to escape persecution have suffered abuse at the hands of authorities or pro-government militias after returning home. Olivia Chan of Reuters reports.
A report from the NGO Human Rights Watch is saying that Syrian refugees who have returned home are risking abuse and persecution, including torture and killings. The report, released on Wednesday, documented 65 cases of arrest, arbitrary detention, torture, extrajudicial killing and enforced disappearances between 2017 and 2021 among those returned from Lebanon and Jordan. This is Sara Kayali, Syrian researcher for the rights group.
I mean, it's very clear to us that the reasons that most of these refugees that have fled in the first place have not been resolved at all. In the past decade, we've seen the Syrian government continue to commit the same abuses that they've committed since 2011, with no reform in sight, with no change in sight.
Authorities have denied returning refugees face torture and reprisals. Syria's conflict has killed hundreds of thousands and displaced millions. And the NGO accuses Lebanon, where many refugees have gone, of pursuing, quote, aggressive returns agenda against refugee. Meanwhile, Jordan has not publicly pushed for large-scale organized repatriations, but has closed many jobs to foreigners, according to Human Rights Watch. The authorities say the move is designed to ease unemployment among locals. Kayali.
The evidence that we have clearly shows that Syrian refugees are at risk of persecution, and any kind of call for Syrians to return prematurely is only going to result in them facing serious risks and even death. These kinds of calls are not grounded in reality.
In an encampment in northern Lebanon, Syrian refugee Abu Allah has heard stories about people being taken to prisons when they reach the borders. He says he would love to go back to his home country, but for now, it is not safe to return.
That's Olivia Chan of Reuters. Witnesses and rescue workers say at least 11 civilians died on Wednesday in a Syrian army shelling of residential areas of rebel-held Ariha City. The shelling from Syrian army outposts, which come shortly after a roadside bomb killed at least 13 military personnel in Damascus, fell on residential areas in the city in the northwestern Idlib province. Among the casualties were several school children, witnesses, and medical workers in the opposition enclave said. This is the Voice of America. The European Union must deepen ties with Taiwan and start work on an investment deal with the island, EU lawmakers said in a resolution adopted on Thursday. The vote angered Beijing, whose similar deal with the EU struck in 2020, has been put on ice. The European Parliament, with a majority of 580 to 26 votes, backed the non-binding resolution asking the bloc's Executive European Commission to, quote, urgently begin an impact assessment, public consultation and scoping exercise on a bilateral investment agreement, unquote. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin offered strong condemnation, unquote, of the resolution. Two new reports show that death, disease, and other health problems linked to global warming are rapidly rising. The medical journal Lancet commissioned the annual report, which tracked 44 global health indicators, and found that they are all getting worse. According to the reports released Wednesday, older people and infants were subject to more days with dangerous heat last year. The World Health Organization says there have been a 7% rise in new coronavirus cases across Europe last week. It's the only region in the world where cases increased. The UN Health Agency said in its weekly assessment of the pandemic released that there were about 2.7 million new COVID cases and more than 46,000 deaths worldwide last week. Coronavirus cases have jumped in Europe for the third consecutive week with about 1.3 million new ones. WHO said more than half of countries in Europe reported a rise in COVID-19 infections, with Britain, Russia, and Turkey accounting for the most cases. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The Biden administration on Wednesday outlined its plan to vaccinate millions of kids ages 5 to 11 as soon as the COVID-19 shot is approved for younger children. This report produced by Jonah Green of Reuters.
We know millions of parents have been waiting for COVID-19 vaccine for kids in this age group. And should the FDA and CDC authorize the vaccine, we will be ready to get shots in arms.
The Biden administration on Wednesday outlined its plan to vaccinate millions of kids ages 5 to 11 as soon as the COVID-19 shot is approved for younger children. Like these sisters who recently took part in a vaccine trial at Duke University,
you did great, sweetie.
Kids will get their shots at clinics in more than 100 children hospital systems nationwide, as well as doctors' offices, pharmacies, and potentially schools, the White House said, as it readies doses ahead of the busy holiday season. White House COVID-19 response coordinator Jeff Zients said the new vaccination campaign would be tailored for children.
Kids have different needs than adults, and our operational planning is geared to meet those specific needs, including by offering vaccinations in settings that parents and kids are familiar with and trust.
He also said the administration had worked with Pfizer to modify the packaging of the pediatric doses to make it easier to administer to children, including providing smaller needles. Food and Drug Administration officials are reviewing the Pfizer-BioNTech application seeking approval of its two-dose vaccine for younger children, with its panel of outside advisors scheduled to weigh in on October 26th. The FDA typically follows the advice of its panel, but is not required to do so. Advisors to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will next weigh in on recommendations for the vaccine at a November 2nd and 3rd meeting. Once approved, roughly 28 million more children in the United States would be eligible to receive what would be the first U.S.-approved vaccine to ward off the novel coronavirus in younger kids. The Pfizer-BioNTech shot is already approved for those ages 12 to 17, and the companies are still studying it for those younger than 5.
China is the center of manufacturing for the world, so when COVID-19 hit, manufacturing was disrupted, production delays gave way to shipping delays. Now it's difficult and sometimes impossible to get certain items. VOA's Karen Presutti looks at what is missing.
Lunch is on at the Green Pig Bistro. It could shape up to be the busiest Saturday in the Virginia restaurant's 10-year history. Customers are back. But beyond the dishes, other things are missing for head chef Tracy O'Grady, an induction burner.
We've been waiting for the part for 2.5 months.
And 4 months for a wine cooler.
It could be on a boat. It could still be in the factory. It could be at a port. It could be on a semi.
COVID-19 has created a major delay in products from China. Also, bottlenecks at American ports have forced dozens of container ships to sit offshore. With no workers to unload and no available warehouse space, there is no path to get products to consumers. It seems most Americans are waiting for something.
Our building has an HVAC system that needs repair, and we've been waiting 2 weeks for the parts, and they're still not here. Same thing with the hot tub on the rooftop building.
These moms worry about Christmas gifts.
I've been trying to get the PS5 for over a year, and there's like blogs that are like where you can find it, and they like come up and say it's available, and by the time you go to the site, they're all gone.
Add to that bicycles, cars, sneakers, and electronics.
Screens, tablets, computers.
James Sampson owns a chain of wireless RXX stores in the Washington, D.C. area. Almost all his components are shipped from China. What used to take 3 to 5 days now takes up to 8 weeks.
It's affecting our end customer. It's affecting the pricing that we have to give to customers because shipping prices are going up. And it's affecting the time we can actually complete repairs.
As a small business owner, Sampson says he can't compete with the huge national chains that are now contracting their own container ships.
It's going to have some long-term effects on us, without a doubt.
Well, good afternoon, everyone.
President Joe Biden says California ports have agreed to operate around the clock, including weekends, to clear out the logjam. Beyond that, he says the U.S. needs to invest in the U.S.
Never again should our country and our economy be unable to make critical products we need because we don't have access to materials to make that product.
Chef O'Grady agrees, but for now, she has to rely on the global economy.
I'm not certain that it affects our bottom line, but it certainly affects our stress level. And it takes me away from things that I really need to be doing.
Like whipping up dishes, not chasing down missing equipment. Carolyn Presutti, VOA News, Arlington, Virginia.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Powell-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofori in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a pleasant evening.